At InDigital, we know the public safety professionals hold themselves to a high standard. In fact, standard doesn't do it justice. In over 25 years working alongside you, carrying millions of calls over our IP networks, your dedication has inspired us. That's why our ESINet goes beyond industry standards, not only I3 compliant, but designed to adapt to future development for a network you can count on when it matters most. Learn more at InDigital.net.
Carbyne, it's multimedia. You can get text, translate to whatever language, getting away with the legacy equipment and going into a cloud-based solution.
It's the first time in U.S. history that we have an EZNet through cloud-native call handling.
As a police officer, to have the victim go video, that's unheard of.
You're getting upgrades every month, not every year.
To schedule your free Carbyne demo, please visit carbyne.com/WTT.
If Within the Trenches has ever taught you something, opened your eyes to what it is like to be a 911 dispatcher, or has inspired you to become one, then help support us and join our Patreon. Get exclusive bonus content, one-of-a-kind swag, discounts on merchandise, ad-free early access to new episodes, and much more. To join, please visit patreon.com/WTTpodcast. And if you're an industry partner, we have something for you as well. And now, for the show.
This is Jordan, and you're listening to the Code 7 Podcast Network.
Warning. This episode contains the three A's of podcasting: adult content, adult language, and awesomeness. You've been warned.
Welcome to Within the Trenches. True stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them.
Hey, what's going on? This is Ricardo with the Code 7 Podcast Network, and this is Within the Trenches, true stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them. This episode is sponsored by InDigital as well as Carbyne, and a big shout out to patrons as always. Thank you for everything. I wouldn't be able to do what I do if it wasn't for all of you, but especially all of you who are watching, listening, sharing, supporting, and just all of the above. So thank you so, so very much. I am currently in my hotel room. As you can see, I've got a different microphone here and everything. Usually the microphone is coming from the bottom up, or sometimes you can't see it at all. But I also usually have different headphones and everything else. I'm at the 2022 Kentucky Emergency Services Conference. And from where I'm sitting, I can see everyone pulling up for the conference in emergency management vehicles, Sheriff's Department, State Police, and everything else. This is an excellent conference. If you have never been here, you need to check it out. It is very affordable. And also the amount of sessions and the people who do all the work here for the conference, top notch. Since the beginning, 4 years ago when I came out here, maybe 5 years ago when I first came out here, it felt like family right away. Everyone is very welcoming and just open arms, and it's a good time. So again, Kentucky Emergency Services Conference and their hospitality suite. I'll just say it's a good time every night of the conference. I don't indulge the way I used to, from the time that I did, it was a lot of fun, a lot of music, a lot of dancing, and just networking, just a lot of good times. So again, make sure to check them out. It was always awesome. And there's a lot of stuff going on. We've got other state conferences that are coming up. Indiana NENA APCO conference is coming up, as well as the Gulf Coast conference in Alabama. And just a whole shitload. I'll just say that. There's just a shitload of things that are coming up right now, and I am super excited for it. And it is also super hot in this room. Holy hell. I turned the AC off because it's really loud. It'll be fine. We'll make it through this. Now, I am very excited for my guest here today. Her name is Cindy Sparrow, and she is the CEO and founder of Cindy Sparrow International, and was also a dispatcher, a 911 professional beforehand. It's still 911 professional now, but in the beginning, dispatch. So this is going to be good. I am excited to have her on, and here we are.
Hello, Ricardo.
How is it going?
It's going really well. Thank you.
Excellent. Now, we were going to do this about a month ago, right? Something like that?
Yeah.
You were in the middle of moving. There were some internet issues. And you know, actually, I was checking it further, and it wasn't just you. It was the both of us. So you were having some issues. And then once we went offline, I was trying to do some other stuff, and it was just destroyed. So I actually will end up having to have someone come out to check out the wiring, because across the street from where I live is this huge field. And I have a suspicion that some jerk off field mice have been destroying my wire.
The fiber seeking field mice always.
Yes, yeah. Like gremlins on a plane, man. I know. What the hell?
Well, it's cool though. I mean, and so it worked out for the best then. And here I am in my new office with a fake background because I'm still surrounded by moving boxes. We just got here on Thursday. So, but I'm so happy to be here with you this morning for me, the afternoon for you in Kentucky. I legit thought you had a new studio. I was like, oh, wow, look at the new digs, fam.
Look at all this.
Yeah, look at everything. It's all mine. Yeah.
Yes. No, actually, just a little bit ago, housekeeping came by. So it's a good thing they came by then.
I love it. Listen, those things are the best. When random strange things happen in the middle of a podcast, you can't control that. I have a construction crew next door building a house. So if you hear, you know, construction noises, I promise it's everything's fine.
Yeah, everything is okay. Right.
That's right. We hear airplanes taking off in your background. It's all par for the course.
Yeah, it's all good. Yeah, we're going to have some fun here. And again, I'm excited to have you on finally. You know, we had a conversation. It was you and your husband and Karen of Rapid SOS and myself. We were out. Where was it at?
Nashville.
It was Nashville, right? Yeah, it was for the Navigator Conference.
You got it.
Yeah, we were out there, and we had dinner and stuff, had some good conversations. It was great music that was going on as well during that time. And immediately I thought, I need to get you on so that we can talk about a lot of this stuff. So let's start from the beginning. You know, how did you get into public safety to begin with?
Well, crazy story. I was originally working three different jobs. I was saving up. I wanted to go to school to be a commercial pilot. And one of those three jobs was working in our local answering service. And in our local answering service, we answered calls for like 100 different oil field companies. I grew up in Northern Alberta in Canada. But also, we didn't even have 911 in my community yet. We had 7-digit numbers for fire, one for fire and one for ambulance, not even the same one for both. And I started answering, ambulance and fire lines back in the day. That would have been in late 1996, early 1997, like 25 plus years ago. But I mean, I'm only 29 and a half, so I don't know how the math works on that. But
whatever. I don't get
whatever.
It.
Yeah. So, and I just recognized that, oh, I really like doing this and I'm actually pretty good at it. Like most of us who get into the profession, we don't even really know what it's all about until we try and do it. So that's really how I got started in public safety. And it just blew up from there.
What were one of the things that I guess, because a lot of times when I talk to people, and I'm sure it's been the same way with you or even your own thought process, you know, it quickly gets into your blood, right? It gets into your system. Now, there's certain things, whether it be for a lot of people, the adrenaline rush, right? Or just the helping aspect of it and all. But what was it for you that really kind of solidified that you were in the right place?
Do you know, I think it was in particular a call where everything kind of came together. So working in a small community, a smaller community, it was about 8,000 people, but it was really a central area for a lot of oil field in the northern part of the province. So there was a ton of people in the outskirts that would come in. We had a flight and we had an air ambulance and ground ambulance. And so we dispatched both of those. There was, I remember a young girl who was babysitting, and the girl she was babysitting was choking and had locked herself in the bathroom and they couldn't get in. And so she was frantic. So I recognized early on, my ambulance director lived down the street. In order to get in the door, the volunteer fire department would have to get to the hall and then respond. The ambulance may or may not have tools to get in. I called the director after I had dispatched ambulance, police and fire. I had called my director who was down the street to tell him what was going on to say, can you go over to this house and see if you can get into the bathroom to help this little girl, until other help can get there. And he went. And we had updated the on-call physician who was in receiving the, all of the incoming inpatients in the hospital that evening. And I've known him since I was a kid because my mom worked at the hospital for a very long, for a lot of years. And he came into the dispatch center and he was, you know, nervous and trying to direct things. And I had control of the situation and I just respectfully said, you need to wait. I know what I'm doing here. I will update you accordingly, because he was trying to direct things, but really he was out of his lane. And so, you know, at like 18 years old, I was able to tell him, listen, this is how it's going to go. And so anyway, long story short, they got to the little girl. It was too late. They did their very best to resuscitate her. But afterward, the doctor had mentioned to my mom, like, wow, I was really impressed with how Cindy handled that whole situation. And my mom said, you should tell her that. And so he came and chatted with me about it. And I just really realized that in crisis, things could become crystal clear to me. I know how to prioritize. I know how to be there for people and reassure them in their, you know, deepest, you know, darkest times, and just organize the chaos and get everything going and start figuring out how to get help to the people who need it. And so for me, it was that one call that in the beginning solidified it. I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm going to go and be a commercial pilot. I think I'm going to stay in emergency services. Yeah. That's where I knew I wanted to be. So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Seriously, I got like goosebumps here. There's those moments that really stick with you, right? And so with that, and especially at 18, mm-hmm. so a lot of us get into this, right? I was 19 when I started, and it's interesting sometimes, because there was a guest spot that I did on another podcast called Tell Us a Good Story, and mm-hmm. I was telling them how old I was, and they said, wow, you know, during that time I was doing, you know, such and such stuff while you were taking these calls and helping save lives or having to do you know, notifications or something like that with family and notices, and having them have to call officers mm-hmm. to get bad news and everything. So, and for you, the exact same thing, like 18 years old and you're dealing with these calls. How did that impact you? Now, one, and the reason I ask is because you already said here, you know, that's really what solidified that you wanted to do this. You didn't want to be, you know, a commercial pilot or anything. You wanted to do what you were doing, but there's also other aspects that how mm-hmm. it impacts you. You know, how do you deal with certain things afterwards? I know when I started, no one really told me, you know, you're going to have to practice some sort of self-care. Like, I don't think at that time in 2001, when I started, I even heard that mm-hmm. term of self-care. It wasn't something that was really talked about. Yeah. So what was that like for you? What further impact was there?
Do you know, for a long time, you're right, there was no self-care. I think that the impact was, I had, and I'm okay with sharing this because it's part of my story, but I had quite a bit of trauma in my childhood growing up, right? So being able to compartmentalize and deal with the situation at hand, but then never knowing that actually that's going to have a cumulative effect on your mental health and well-being. And it's going to show up in other ways that even if you're not experiencing any kind of distress, it's going to show up in different ways. And so I can share with you that there was one call in particular where it had kind of hit a crescendo. So a lot of the stuff that we deal with, you're right, it's mostly just like, I came from a culture of like, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen, or just suck it up and move on, you know, things like that. Not that it was, people weren't, you know, in your face about it or mean about it, but that was the overall culture. And you know it, because you have to check the temperature on culture to know, how do I fit in and survive in this place that I really want to do my work in, right? So knowing that, and I mean, that's the work you and I focus on now, right, is because people don't know before they get into, so we want them to arm them with the information well ahead of time. But I think for me, where it really came to a head was, and we can get into this later in the story, part of my journey through emergency services was I also decided to become a paramedic. So I've always worked in the comm center, and I got an opportunity to work on both sides of the radio. I got to work in the field frontline as in 911 and out in an ambulance. We did air and ground ambulance in Slave Lake, as well as in the other communities that I worked in throughout different parts of the province. And so I think that combined with all of the dispatch trauma that I was exposed to, and then responding in my hometown to one of my very best friends who had taken his life, it was tough. And in fact, I almost left my career because of it. I didn't know what critical incident stress was. And I didn't really understand the signs and symptoms that I was experiencing, but I knew that I felt like I just couldn't get over it. I was having massive flashbacks. There was a time for in the first couple of weeks where I could not stop my racing thoughts and I thought I was going crazy. I remember having a long drive home because I was still working in my hometown, but I had actually taken a position in a larger department south in a city in southern Alberta. So it was about a 6 to 8 hour drive, depending on weather, back and forth. But I'd have 6 days off at a time with my new schedule. So I would still go and work ambulance or in dispatch in Slave Lake. I had a long drive home 2 days after he had taken his life and I'd responded to the call. And I just remember thinking like, I'm going crazy and maybe this isn't the career for me. Maybe I can't handle it. Maybe I need to get out. It took a really long time to recover. Partway through, a couple of weeks afterhand, when I was back at the other department I was working for, one of my coworkers took me aside and said, are you okay? Like, what's going on? And I told them and they said, you know what? We have what's called critical incident stress debriefing. Let's get you connected with somebody to get you some help. And once I understood that what I was going through was completely normal, and the reaction I was having was totally normal when we're dealing with such abnormal traumatic impacts, that it's normal for your body to respond that way, right? But everything in life before I had managed to get through. And so this felt different and I felt like maybe I was broken or something was wrong. Mm-hmm. So from that point, I've always been involved in mental health advocacy for our profession because knowledge is powerful. I don't want people to feel alone or broken or like they're the only one. They're not. We are faced with such exposure to stress and trauma in the work that we do. And it's so important that we learn how to take care of ourselves and each other. So there's only so many of us that can do this work, right? So super important, which is why I left being a chief and started my own company so I could help more all across North America.
It's interesting hearing you talking about this and me kind of thinking about my time as well. Mm-hmm. And how in the beginning it was almost like an embarrassment or shame, right? To almost admit that you have an issue.
Yep.
Or that something's going on. And I know I've said this many times and I'll continue to say it. No one wants to have to look in the mirror and realize that you have a problem. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. You have to face that. And it was the same for me as it was for you. And I love that we have conversations like this and to be able to share these experiences, these stories, because it also allows people to realize that there is no shame, mm-hmm. or embarrassment in sharing these type of stories. You know, it's good to get it out there. And but in the beginning, you know, you don't know that. You don't know what you don't know. And because you don't hear other people talking about it as well, you feel like, okay, maybe I'm the only one.
It's true. You just sit alone in the silence, right? And the more we can talk about it and be real about what's happening, because there was a time when it wasn't safe to talk about things like that in some people's agencies, right? And in some places, it's still like that. There's still work to do to lift that shame and stigma. But the more that we show up and say, like, listen, it happens. It can happen to any of us. Some of us are going to be, we're all going to be impacted by the work that we do. That's the reality. So let's arm you with the tools and information that you need so that you can get through this. Okay. And make it safe for you to reach out for support and be surrounded instead of, you know, ridiculed for needing help. And the statistics from the research that I've done, statistics show that we are so deeply, we deeply identify with emergency services as a career, but also as part of who we are. So that association to our peers and our coworkers is so vital. But you know what happens when someone has to book off on medical leave when they have mental health injuries? Often, still, and definitely in the past, you're ostracized from your group, right? Because people either don't know how to react or they're pissed off because you're taking time off during summer when for a nice vacation, it's like, no, I'm trying to tend to my mental health so I can be okay, right? There's all of that kind of stuff that goes on in the background. But the more we can open up and help people realize that, like, that stuff can't happen anymore. And your association to your coworkers and your peers is so vital. So it's important that we have that be healthy as possible. Because when people lose that and they have no other support system in place, that's when they're in trouble, real trouble.
Right. And you have to kind of figure out who you can and can't turn to. Because mm-hmm. there's there's a lot of people that you work with, some of them that you can definitely go to, and others you're like, oh,
I know.
you're not for sure. Now, going back a little bit, back to the beginning, mm-hmm. what was like the training and everything for you? Because this is, what location is this now? And what are mm-hmm. some of the differences?
I'll tell you. Yeah. So I'll tell you, in the very beginning, it was, you answered the phone and you said Slave Lake Ambulance or Slave Lake Fire. My training was, here's the phone line. Here's the recorder that needs to be changed every 24 hours. And so, yeah, just get the address and then send the ambulance. No caller management techniques, absolutely zero protocol.
Oh,
yeah. It was like nothing. It's like, yeah. And then here's the little punch card that you have where you write the address on and you write the information on it. And then there's like a little time clock punch card, you know, that was like, mm-hmm. you know, dinosaur CAD back yeah. in the day where you put underneath, it's like ka-chunk, that's the timestamp. It's really high tech and very legal, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was what the training was like, actually, in the very, very beginning. And that was when we were at the answering service. And then when we became a fully fledged 911 center, I had talked to the director about, like, we should have a more well-rounded training program that isn't just about teaching them here's the phone and here's the cards. There was protocol. They did implement EMD protocol, which was lovely, and that was in like 1998. So I've been using like EMD protocol for 40 years and Q and all of those kinds of lovely things. So not 40 years, I lied. Jesus, it's been around for like 50 years or something. but for like 20, from the beginning of my career, I've mm-hmm. been using medical protocol, which is wonderful and so helpful for streamlining training. But yeah, it was non-existent in the beginning. It was, so as much fun as it, not fun, as much as I loved work, it was also terrifying at times, right? Because it's like, okay, well, I'll just figure this out then, because nobody, I don't know what to do. So I'll just figure it out on my own. Not everybody thrives in those situations.
Right. Yeah. Cause you're kind of being thrown to the lions, mm-hmm. right? You're just getting thrown in there and it's like sink or swim. We'll see how it goes. And, it was similar for me in the beginning. I started out a small, police department, and it was one dispatcher on for 8 hours. And, that first night I'm there with my trainer and I observe a 911 call. And then he's like, all right, you're next. And I was like, no way. Like this, there's gotta be more to this. And yeah. I just remember him basically saying that, the profession and the job that we're doing, it's basically being human, having thick skin and common sense. And you got to jump in there. And, you know, the only way you're going to learn is by doing this. Now I will say though, a week or two later, I ended up going to a 40-hour dispatcher's beginner's course. So there was more training, but that first night, that was it. Here's the radio. Here's the phone. These are some of the questions that you ask. Do it to it.
Yep. You're like, okay, no pressure. I hope I do all right. And then you just do a little dispatch
prayer. And, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the truth.
2001. Yeah. That was 2001, and Jeez. We didn't have like a real CAD system either. We didn't have the punch card system, at least not there. A coworker of mine, another dispatcher that was there, was going to college for computer technology, and
you
somehow
have an access database. We had one of those.
Well, so we had a version of that, but also for CAD. What he did was he created his own out of like Microsoft Excel or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't remember how, but. He had created something for us. So that was my taste of what a CAD system would be. Yeah. When I ended up moving back home to Southwest Michigan, we had a full-fledged CAD and things were definitely different. But when the CAD would go down at night for 4 hours, we had those punch cards. We just didn't have the punch thing. We had to write everything down. So it was just straight up paper and pen.
Yeah.
Good time.
I know, it is good times. It's crazy how far we've come, right? Like to now full-fledged systems and everything is incredibly technologically mm-hmm. based, and we've come a long way. We've seen a lot of things in this industry in 25 years. Wow.
Right. And so there's a question then, how has technology changed since you started? There's one. So there's a two-parter. So how much has technology changed since the time you started? But also, how does that technology, do you feel, kind of impact also that mental health and wellness for those that are, you know, still in the chair, still within the trenches of 911?
So, yep, technology has changed a ton. So for the first part, a ton. I mean, I went from a 7-digit number and no protocol, no technology whatsoever, except for a recorder for the calls and some paper and a time clock that your time punch thingy, to a fully fledged, you know, CAD system, high tier, multi-jurisdictional, multi-agency, call taker, dispatcher. I've worked in all kinds of centers, from like a 1-seat center to like a 20-seat center. So I have to say, like, it's changed drastically. It's gone from almost none to a ton. And so, yeah, do we rely on technology heavily? Yeah, we do, because it creates efficiencies and it creates a trail for the actions that we take. And it also, you know, helps you to easily access whatever you need to get the job done. Mm-hmm. But with that, some of the mental health impacts of the constant technology is, and this is why when we talk about quality assurance, it's really important what we measure. So, you know, your time's measured from the time you answer the phone until you dispatch the first crew, or your call answer time, your call dispatch time, all of that kind of stuff is being checked in a lot of agencies, and people are held to account for meeting the standard or not. And so some of the extra stress and pressure it can put on us is, if we as leaders don't do a good job of analyzing some of the barriers that could be in the way of people getting to the call quickly and getting it dispatched quickly, and we don't remove them, but we are constantly putting that onus on our teams, that added layer of constant scrutiny amongst, you know, from the people who are there to supervise us, as well as from the public, as well as from the responding crews out in the field, you know, it just adds to the weight of the work that happens to us. Combine that with our stress and trauma exposure, that's pretty regular. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you're at a 1-seat center or at a multi-seat center, you're going to be exposed to that just by virtue of what we do. It can have a massive impact, but it can also, if it's used properly, be able to identify early on the kinds of calls that some of our people are being exposed to, so that we know how to get in there with early intervention and support them to say, how are you doing? I want to check in on you. I know you've had, you know, a couple of cardiac arrest calls. You had, you know, some people trapped in a burning building. There's some critical incidents where we start to have that dialogue and that language and that support that happens from leadership down to say, are you okay? Right. So as much as it can, if it's used the way we can, to the best of our ability, it can be really helpful for us too, and not cause as much stress on us.
I agree. I feel like there is, I've been talking about this for a few years now, but I feel like there's a way, if used properly and implemented also properly, and having, you know, the different types of protocols and training and everything put in place, that some of the stuff that those who are using this technology will see will help maybe a little bit with mm-hmm. the closure situation, because, you know, that's what's one of the biggest things, right, that we deal with is not having closure, right? And that definitely impacts us. And I feel like, in a way, of course, I've heard of a lot of companies that who are allowing video to 911 and such, and pictures and everything, they are allowing them to choose what they want to see, which is great. I love that they're doing that. They're working with different centers to be able to do that. And if they do choose to see what it is that's going on, then, you know, I kind of feel like that might help out with that closure situation a little bit.
Agreed. Do you know, in Canada, as we roll out Next Gen 911, video is not in the works yet. Not yet. It will be coming. But one of the things that as leaders that we get to have say on with CRTC, which is the equivalent of your FCC, there's an emergency services working group organization that represents, you know, leaders and comm centers. A lot of the people I work with are on it or involved or get to influence in some way, shape or form. We want the approach you're talking about when it comes to video. When it comes to video, we get to decide what we will pull in. And people don't just get to randomly send pictures and videos because of the massive trauma exposure that it can create. While some of it is required for evidence, maybe that gets streamlined down to records and somebody else somewhere else gets to see that as some kind of evidence for what happened at scene. But so while we're figuring all that out, those kinds of conversations are already happening about how can we make sure that we're limiting the exposure for people in our centers as much as possible. The other thing as well is with some of the mental health professionals that I work with, there is some research going on in the background for AI and kinetic biology, where before the call comes to the caller, when it comes to like video, they're trying to create things that can analyze to see what the scene looks like for the video that's going to be sent. If it's graphic or there's a suspected, you know, that somebody is dead or there's a lot of trauma or something they shouldn't see, or not that they shouldn't see, that something that is high in trauma exposure, that right. There's a method for saying like, nope, this is not, if this isn't needed for the call, then we're not going to send it through to you, to try and also limit that. So using AI technology, now it's obviously in its infancy, but the reality is in our lifetime in this industry, those kinds of things will exist. So again, when we use technology for good to help people on both sides of the phone, our own people in the center, as well as the general public,
you know, that makes sense because, you know, some of the social media platforms, when they first started doing their live broadcasts, allowing everybody to do, you know, live stuff, after a while, and I don't remember how long it went, but after a while, they started putting out a lot of AI tools, right? Mm-hmm. So to be able to identify whether a person was dealing with some sort of trauma while live, right? Because some people were suicidal and they were going live and doing this. So they implemented this AI. So it definitely makes sense to do the same thing in 911 as well when video is coming over, to be able to have those types of tools to analyze the situation. And like you said, you know, the different levels or severity of what it is that they're going to see and how much trauma that could cause to everyone else, I'm sure it would come up as like a pop-up window saying, this is the level that it's at. You can forward this to the officer that's going out there or however, you sure. know, they end up doing it. But to be able to determine that right off the bat, that's pretty good.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. So my hope is that they get it out there sooner or later.
Now, how many years were you in dispatch before you went on your own?
Oh, 25. Yeah.
25.
I worked frontline. I've always worked in comms my entire career, even when I was a flight and ground paramedic. Mm-hmm. I started frontline in Northern Alberta and then moved to a community in Southern Alberta and then Central Alberta. Our province is quite big. There's a lot of people who know probably where Alberta, Canada is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I was frontline for probably half of my career. For the last 14 years of my career, I was in a management or a deputy chief position, mm-hmm. where I provided, you know, oversight. My portfolio always included the comm center, management of the comm center. And so working my way through the ranks, I was, you know, frontline in 911. I've worked in police, fire, and EMS dispatch. And I've been a frontline supervisor. I've been QA and QI, training coordinator, love training, all the way up to, deputy chief. So
nice.
It's been a really cool, full career. That's for sure.
So all that experience, mm-hmm. all around, really, experience mm-hmm. and everything, you're bringing that to what it is that you're doing now. So you ended up transitioning out, not still in the profession, but out of the, you know, the comm center and everything. What was the motivation for that transition, and what is it exactly that, you know, I guess your mission, your goal with, Cindy Sparrow International?
Do you know, the motivation was, I knew that I could make a difference in comm centers. I could do it one at a time, and I could do it, you know, a few at a time. I was involved in our, the APCO Canada, I was president, you know, so I've always been an advocate for our industry and the people in our industry. And especially as a leader in our industry, probably my biggest passion is people. Mm-hmm. And so I'm all about helping helpers, because who helps us, right? And we've got to be able to have the advocacy, the support, the tools to be able to take care of ourselves. And I think that was my biggest push, is that I knew I had done everything I wanted to in a frontline career with a single agency. And I had an opportunity to do some work consulting. And I knew that. So with Cindy Sparrow, I took the leap. I created my own company. I got to partner with a few other agencies, one in the UK and one in the US. I still work with one in the US, which is lovely. But I do work on my own as well. Mm-hmm. But 3 weeks before COVID, I made the leap, not knowing what was going to happen.
Yeah.
There was a lot of change in a short amount of time. And I was like, oh, okay. let's figure this out. So we did. And emergency services still went on. It was like, if anything, we were deeply impacted to the other degree where there was no layoffs and job shortages. There were a lot of position shortages and people short in a center that still, we needed to still keep going to work and serving the public, right? We didn't get to stay home. There was no really COVID leave for us. In fact, it got even more scary because of all of the impacts of COVID and the concerns, and then taking care of, you know, children and family members who now we've got to be on shift and they're not in school and all of the things. Anyway, so I made that leap just after COVID. It's all worked out wonderfully. So there's three real pillars of work that I do. The first one being public safety consulting, where I go into agencies all over North America and I help them with any kind of project they have, whether it's people or technology or process. It can be like a full comm center assessment for staffing and technology and culture. It can be next gen 911 based, really any kind of anything that it would take to run a department and a center. I can go in and help kind of uncover some of the challenges they're having, help them get to where they want to be with any improvements that they want to make. The second pillar is leadership. So I have a master's in leadership. I actually went and took my master's degree. Leadership is so vital in the work that we do. Good leadership can bring out the very best in people, and bad leadership, well, we know, because I mean, people will always remember the leaders that were not great to them. Leadership has the single most impactful influence on somebody's well-being and in their career. And so when you think about that and you think that about the work that we do, getting leadership right is so important. And so for me, I have a leadership program for public safety leaders. It's a group consulting program where people who are already in the leadership role get to come in and kind of do some self-discovery on who they are as a leader, who they want to be as a leader, kind of takes the complexity and overwhelm out of the leadership in public safety and helps set them up for not necessarily the skills that are like, I'm not going to teach you how to do budgets. I'm not going to teach you how to do, you know, those kinds of things. The task-based stuff, there's a lot of great programs out there. This is really about evolving to the next level leader that you want to be so that you can make the influence and impact that you want, empower your teams to be able to work through some of the most difficult, challenging work, but most rewarding work that we do at the same time. And then the third pillar is, and they go part and parcel, is mental health education, and resilience education and advocacy. Huge advocate for our industry and the men and women in our industry. Because having been in the trenches, you know, I don't ever want to be so out of touch with what's really going on. I don't ever want to be so privileged that I lose sight of the fact of what's still going on. And that's why I work in all three of those pillars. I'm in comm centers all the time across Canada and the US, connecting with people, understanding what's going on for them so that I can do a better job of helping them get what they need to do their best work when they're in there. I mean, there's only so many of us that can do this work, and we have to be able to essentially save ourselves, right? And so the huge part of what you do, a huge part of what I do, is making sure that we can be the advocates for our brothers and sisters in those comm centers. And so that's my passion. My passion is the people side of the work that we do. That's the bottom line for why I do what I do.
Damn. That is awesome. That is excellent. You know, again, you know, bringing all of that experience into what it is that you're doing now. And it just helps to have, you know, more of us that are doing this and pushing it, because for a long time there wasn't anything, right? You know, you kind of had to look on your own, but then again, if you didn't know where to look, you're just kind of there. So, you know, a lot of us kind of out of our own experience and things that we were going through, wanting to leave this profession in a better spot than where we started with it, right?
You got it.
Those folks, they don't have to go through some of that bullshit that we went through in the beginning. Now they have those. And they'll experience their own things, of course, but they'll have the tools and the resources to be able to help themselves and others.
It's true. That's exactly right. It is exactly right. We want to leave people and our industry better than we found it. And that's our legacy, right? Like, that's why we work our tails off to do the work we do, to do the research. Like, guess what? You know what? I'm not running a comm center anymore. I can be out here doing the research, connecting with people all over the place to get this work, to move things forward, just like you. You know, the massive advocacy you've done with IM911, with everything that you do, it puts like faces and people who are attached on the other end of that phone. They matter. Our people in the centers, they absolutely matter. nobody's going anywhere for police, fire, and ambulance calls if there's no one in the center to take care of biz. And we've been a neglected part of the industry for a long time. And I'm not shaming and blaming or finger pointing. I'm just saying enough. We have voices and we're going to use them and you're going to hear us. And you need to understand who we are, what we provide, and get the support and tools that we need to keep going.
It's kind of funny and kind of a weird irony that our biggest weapon all these years has been our voice, mm-hmm. right? It's been our voices. However, for a long time, they've been silent.
It's true.
But it's a new day and we're doing everything that we can. And that's why, again, conversations like this are very important. And we're running a little low on time.
I
know you have to get somewhere. But we are definitely going to do either a part two or we're going to do a dispatcher roundtable. There's a lot more that we have to talk
tons
about.
Tons to unpack. Yeah, tons to unpack.
One last question, and then I want to know where everyone else can find out everything that you're doing with Cindy Sparrow International. But here's the question.
Okay.
If you could go back in time with the knowledge that you have now and speak to yourself to give yourself some advice, what would you tell yourself?
Oh my gosh, right in the feels. To not be so hard on myself. To know that we do make a difference in what we do, that it won't always be easy, but to keep going and then it's all worth it in the end. To just keep going, I guess. You know, it's been for a lot of us and still for a lot of us, it was tough coming through the ranks and doing our work without the support that we needed to keep going. And sometimes you wonder, like, am I making the difference that I'm making? I would tell my younger self, don't be so damn hard on yourself. It's going to be okay. Don't take it so seriously. You don't have to kill yourself to, like, you know, make. I would have recognized my worth a lot sooner, and I would have just been nicer to myself, I think, while I went along the way. But it's cool because we've done that work and we're different now. So
yes.
I say we, but I only have one personality, just for clarification. Yeah, I think that's what I would tell myself is, wow, I didn't expect that to hit me right in the heart, but it did. So, yeah.
That just shows how important this all is and how much this means to you. So thank you so, so much for everything that you do and for what you're doing now for people with Cindy Sparrow International. And speaking of which, how can people find out more? Email, website, social media, all of that.
Okay, great. So email is cindy@cindysparrow.com. You can check out my website at cindysparrow.com and you can connect with me through there. I'm on Instagram at Cindy Sparrow International and then on Facebook. You can find me and add me, Cindy Sparrow.
Awesome. Thank you so much, my friend, for being on. And we are definitely going to do another episode because there's a lot more that we have to talk about.
I'm so excited. Thank you so much, Ricardo. And thank you for the difference you make in our industry too. The work you're doing is massive and so very important. And you've connected so many of us. So we have a platform to make the difference we need to. So thank you for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that more than you know. I will be right back here with you in just one second. For those who are watching and listening, if you have any comments, questions, or you want to be a guest on the show, you can email us, and that's going to be wttpodcast@gmail.com. Once again, that is wttpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, that is @91podcast. You can like us on Facebook, that is facebook.com/withinthetrenchespodcast. This episode has been sponsored by InDigital as well as Carbine, and a big shout out to patrons as always. Thank you so, so much for everything. If you want to become a patron and support us, you can hit us up here, patreon.com/wttpodcast. This can be seen on Facebook, YouTube, as well as Twitter. And you can listen 24/7 on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, your favorite podcasting app, and withinthetrenches.net. Have a good one, everyone, and we'll see you in the next one.
You just listened to a Code 7 Network podcast. If you have any questions or would like to be a guest on the show, send an email to wttpodcast@gmail.com.